Sovereign Grace Fellowship and Presbyterian Church, welcome to the last Pilgrim's Progress Sunday School. So, with it being the last Pilgrim's Progress Sunday School, you could imagine, Christian and Hopeful have been going from the City of Destruction to the Celestial City. And so, this is the last Sunday School. We're going to glory today. We're going to the Celestial City. There are technically four chapters left. We're going to skip one chapter, and then the chapter that we're going to start with is called The Deep River. That's where Christian and Hopeful die their death. Everyone is consigned to die. You and I are going to die. And then we go to glory. That's what we're going to look at today. The one chapter that we're starting with, Christian and Hopeful die. It's called The Deep River. The river is an allegorical depiction of death. You go through the river and you come out on the other side of the river, clothed with immortality. And then the next chapter is them being received into the gates of Zion through a procession of angelic hosts. It's a glorious depiction, and hopefully it encourages you and forces you to think about what you have awaiting for you as long as you believe upon Jesus and are united to him in faith, by faith. So, so those are the two chapters we're looking at. The last chapter is, we're just going to skip it. It's very short, but I just figured we'll skip it. The first chapter that we're skipping, I just thought what Bunyan is trying to do there is he's trying to conjure up the right kind of affections that we should have for glory, okay? For our eternity in Zion, with God's people, where God will dwell with his people. And the way that he does that is he brings into this, what kind of affections does Bunyan want us? What kind of affections does the Bible want us to have as we think about glory? As we think about eternity with God. And the kind of affections are the kind of affections between a husband and a wife. Why? Of course, because we are going to exist as God's people eternally as the bride of Christ. And so that's what Bunyan is trying to conjure up here. As you think about eternity, you want to be thinking about that kind of love. Just a deep, deep affection for God. But Piper often asks the question, would you want to go to heaven even if God were not there? If God were not there, would you still want to go? We should say no. We should say that's not heaven. That does not sound like heaven. Heaven is where God dwells with his people perfectly. And then you could even rephrase that, and what Bunyan is trying to get at here. Would you want to go to heaven if your eternal husband were not there? Would you want to go? And you should say no, because there is a sort of love that is missing in the kind of heaven that God, if there were no marriage between Christ and the bride, that's not heaven. The love is missing, the joy is missing, and so that's Bunyan here with this chapter. He's trying to fill us up with that kind of love. And so the way he does that is he has Christian and Hopeful go through what's called the country of Beulah, B-E-U-L-A-H, and that is a Hebrew word for marriage. Okay, so he gets that from Isaiah 62. So I'm just going to read Isaiah 62 to you really quick. And I think as I'm reading this, you might even hear a little bit of Ephesians 5, where Paul says that he says, "Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of the water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish." So that's the kind of love that Christ has for us, and of course we should return with a certain sort of bridal affection for our husband. And as men, that may be hard to understand, but I'm going to be a bride for the rest of my life. But think about it this way. What does Christ do as our husband? He protects you. He nourishes you. He rejoices over you. He grants you an eternity of wealth and joy. What kind of man doesn't want that? We may have to toss away some of our John Wayne instincts here, but that's what we have to look forward to. So Isaiah 62, you get some of that Ephesians 5 imagery here, and this is the passage that Bunyan is using in that chapter in order to conjure up within us the right kind of affections as we enter into the gates of glory. So here we go. Isaiah 62. "For Zion's sake, I will not keep silent." This is God speaking here. I will not keep silent for Zion's sake, and for Jerusalem's sake I will not keep quiet, until her righteousness goes forth as brightness, and her salvation as a burning torch. The nations shall see your righteousness, and all the kings your glory, and you shall be called by a new name that the mouth of the Lord Yahweh will give. You shall be a crown of beauty in the hand of the Lord, and a royal diadem in the hand of your God. You shall no more be termed forsaken, and your land shall no more be termed desolate, but you shall be called, My delight is in her, and your land shall be called Beulah, the country of Beulah. Your land shall be called married. Okay? And so, as a Christian hopeful were traveling through this country, they found themselves just being filled with almost tears of love and affection, just overwhelming joy as a bride to her husband, a husband to her bride. And that's what you want to be, go to heaven, if the husband of God's people was not there protecting and loving, rejoicing over his bride. Of course, the answer is no, because then that sort of love is missing. And that's a very important thing. That's why we're going to talk about no in the discussion, but that's so long as our love for God is there, we have reason to praise him, and we will not get bored in heaven. So, at the end of this chapter on the country of Beulah, Christian and Hopeful meet two shining angelic beings, and they say this to Christian and Hopeful. They say, you have only two more difficulties to encounter, and then you are in the city. I don't know what the two difficulties are. I know what one of them is, and it's very obvious. It's that deep river. It's death. You still have to die. That is a trial. There is a sting in death. So you have that difficulty to overcome, and then you are in the city. I don't know what the second one is. The angels seem to say that there are two more difficulties. But anyway, so and then Christian and his companion asked the men to go along with them. So these angelic beings were going to pick up in a deep river, where Christian and Hopeful are talking to these angelic beings that they met in the country of Beulah. And these two beings said that they would go with them, but they said, you must obtain it by your own faith. You must get through the river and obtain the glory on the other side of the river by your own faith. The angelic beings are not going to just carry you over the river. So I saw in my dream that they went along together and so they could see the gates. And then we will pick up from there in our reading. So take a moment to look through the questions. And just so you know, what to be looking for as I'm reading to you. And you know the rest if you've been doing this. So, all right, enjoy.
It's story time. The last story time here. chapter 23, A Deep River, and then chapter 24, The Paradise of God. Now I saw that there was a river between them and the gate, but there was no bridge by which to go over. The river was very deep. The pilgrims were overwhelmed when they saw this river. The men, the angels, who were traveling with them said, you must go through it, or you cannot get to the gate. The pilgrims then began to inquire about another way to the gate, to which they answered, yes, but there have not been any except for two, namely Enoch and Elijah, who have been permitted to walk that path since the foundation of the world. Nor shall there be any more until the last trumpet will sound. The pilgrims then, especially Christian, began to be despondent. They looked all around but could not find a way by which they might escape the river. Then they asked the men if the water was the same depth everywhere, and they said, no, but they could not help them in that matter. They said, you will find it deeper or shallower according to your belief in the king of the place. Then they approached the water. As they entered, Christian began to sink. Crying out to his good friend, Hopeful, he said, I am sinking in deep waters. The billows are going over my head. All his waves are going over me. Hopeful responded, well, be of good cheer, my brother. I feel the bottom and it is good. Then Christian said, Ah, my friend, the sorrows of death have surrounded me. I will not see the land that flows with milk and honey. And with that, a great darkness and horror fell upon Christian, so that he could not even see in front of him. Alas, also, it was here that, to a great extent, he lost his senses and could not remember nor talk about any of the pleasant refreshments he had encountered during his pilgrimage. All the words he spoke betrayed the fact that his mind was filled with horror and overpowering fears that he would die in the river and never obtain entrance at the gate. Here also, as perceived by those who stood by, he was troubled by the sins he had committed, both before and after he became a pilgrim. It was also observed that he was troubled with frightening apparitions of the evil spirits. Every now and then he would intimate this by his words. Now, Hopeful, therefore, had troubles keeping his brother's head above the water. Sometimes Christian would go under and then surface again half dead. Hopeful would try to comfort him, saying, Brother, I see the gates and men standing by it to receive us. But Christian would not answer. It is you. It is you they are waiting for. You have been hopeful ever since I met you. And so have you, he said to Christian. Ah, brother, Christian said, surely if I was right, the king would now arise to help me. But because of my sins, he has brought me into this snare, and he has left me. Then Hopeful replied, My brother, you have forgotten the text that speaks about the wicked. They have no struggles. Their bodies are healthy and strong. They are free from the burdens common to man. They are not plagued by human ills. The trouble and anguish that you go through in these waters are not a sign that God has forsaken you. They are only sent to try you, to determine whether you will recall those things you have received by his goodness and rely on him in your distress. Then I saw in my dream that Christian was meditating for a while. Hopeful added this word to him, Be of good cheer! Jesus Christ makes you whole! And with that, Christian broke out with a loud voice, Oh, I see again! And he tells me, When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and when you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. That's a quotation from Isaiah 43. Then they both were encouraged, and after that, the enemy was as still as a stone until they had crossed over. Christian found ground to stand on and discovered the rest of the river was shallow. So they crossed over to the other side. There, on the banks of the river, they saw two shining ones who were there waiting for them. When the pilgrims came up out of the river, the shining ones saluted them, and saying, We are ministering spirits sent to minister to those who will be heirs of salvation. Then they went along toward the gate. Now you must note that the city stood upon a mighty hill, but the pilgrims went up the hill with ease, because they had these two men lead them up by the arms. Also, they had left their mortal garments behind them in the river. Although they had gone in with them, they came out with them. Therefore, they went up the hill with much agility and speed, even though the foundation of the city that the city was built upon was higher than the clouds. They traveled even higher, having an amiable conversation as they walked. They experienced comfort because they had safely crossed the river and had such glorious companions to welcome them. Chapter 24, The Paradise of God. Now, the conversation Christian and Hopeful had with these shining ones was about the glory of the place. They told them that the beauty and glory of it was inexpressible. There, they said, is Mount Zion, the heavenly Jerusalem, and the innumerable company of angels and the spirits of the righteous men made perfect. You are now going to the paradise of God, where you will see the tree of life and eat the fruit that never withers. And when you arrive, you will have white robes given to you. You will walk and talk every day with the king throughout all eternity. There you will not see the things you saw when you were on earth, sorrow, sickness, affliction, and death, for the former things have passed away. You are now going to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and to the prophets, men whom God has taken away from the evil which is to come. They are now experiencing their eternal rest, each one walking in his righteousness. The men then asked, "What will we do in the holy place?" And they were answered, "You will receive comfort from all your labors and have joy for all of your sorrow. You must reap what you have sown, even the fruits of all your prayers, tears, and sufferings for the king. In that place you will wear crowns of gold and enjoy the perpetual sight and visions of the Holy One. For there you shall see him as he is. There also you will serve him continually with praise, with shouting and thanksgiving, whom you desired to serve in the world, but did so with much difficulty because of the weakness of your flesh. There your eyes will be delighted with seeing and your ears with hearing the pleasant voice of the Mighty One. There you will again enjoy your friends who have gone before you. And there you will receive with joy everyone who will follow you into the holy place. You will also be clothed with glory and majesty and ride in a carriage with the King of Glory. When he will come with the sound of the trumpets and clouds, as upon the wings of the wind, you will come with him. When he sits upon the throne of judgment, you will sit with him. And when he passes sentence upon all the workers of iniquity, whether they be angels or men, you will also have a voice in that judgment, because they were his and your enemies. When he will again return to the city, you will also go with the sound of the trumpet and be with him forever." Now while they were approaching the gates, behold, a company of the heavenly host came out to meet them. Two other shining ones said, "These are the men who have loved our Lord when they were in the world, and who have left all for his holy name. And he has sent us to bring them here. We have brought them this far on their desired journey, that they may go in and see their Redeemer face to face with joy." Then the heavenly host gave a great shout, saying, "Blessed are those who are invited to the wedding supper of the Lamb." At this time, several of the king's trumpeters, clothed in white and shining garments, came out to meet them. With melodious and majestic music, they made the heavens reverberate with their sound. These trumpeters saluted Christian and his companion with 10,000 welcomes. They did this with shouting and the sound of the trumpet. Having done this, they surrounded them on every side, some in front of them, some behind, and some on the right, and some on the left, to guard them, as it were, through the upper regions. As they went along, they made melodious sounds with extremely high notes. The very sight of this was, to those who could behold it, as if heaven itself had come down to meet them. So they walked down together. And as they walked, every now and then these trumpeters would let Christian and his brother know how welcome they were into their company by making joyful sounds and by combining their music with admiring looks and gestures. They also made it apparent how glad they were to come and meet them. And now these two men were in heaven, as it were, before they arrived at the gate. They were swallowed up with the sight of the angels, and with hearing their melodious music. Here also they had the city itself in view, and they thought they heard all the bells in it ringing to welcome them. But above all, they had warm and joyful thoughts about their living there with this throng forever and ever. Oh, by what tongue or pen can their glorious joy be expressed? Thus they came up to the gate. Now, when they had come up to the gate, there were written over it in gold letters, Blessed are those who wash their robes, that they may have right to the tree of life, and may go through the gates into the city. Then I saw in my dream that the shining ones requested that they call at the gate. When they did, some from above looked over the gate, including Enoch, Moses, and Elijah, to whom it was said, These pilgrims have come from the city of destruction because of the love that they have for the king of this place. Then the pilgrims gave them their certificates, which they had received at the beginning. These rolls were carried in to the king, and when he had read them, he asked, Where are these men? He was answered, They are standing outside the gate. The king then commanded that the gate be opened, that the righteous nation may enter, the nation that keeps faith. Now I saw in my dream that these two men went in at the gate. As they entered, they were transfigured. They had garments put on them that shone like gold. Those who met them also gave them harps and crowns, the harps with which to praise and the crowns as a token of honor. Then I heard in my dream that all the bells in the city rang again with joy, and it was said to them, Enter into the joy of your Lord. I also heard the men singing with loud voices, saying, To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be praise and honor and glory and power forever and ever. Now just as the gates were opened to let them in, I looked in after them. And behold, the city shone like the sun. The streets were paved with gold, and many people walked on them with crowns on their heads, palms in their hands, and golden harps with which to sing praises. There were also creatures who had wings. They answered one another without interruption, saying, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord. Then they shut the gates. And after I had seen that sight, I wished that I myself was among them. And that is the end of Pilgrim's Progress. Technically, there is one more chapter. It's one brief paragraph, but I didn't read it because it includes stuff that we didn't read about earlier. It includes the conclusion of Ignorance, who I kind of skipped over through the reading. But, that is it's a glorious description of what awaits us as Christians. And so I'm going to give you a few moments to look at the discussion guide, and maybe you can discuss and converse from that guide with your family members, or just ponder through it on your own if you are sitting at home alone. And then you can hit play again, and I will give you my thoughts. So you've heard the story now, and perhaps you've gone through the discussion questions. So let me go through some of these questions with you and give you some of my own insights here. So the first question, the challenged people are always seeking to overcome regarding death deals with this question. How do I overcome my fear of death? Okay, so that's what's first presented to us in the chapter on a deep river. As when the angels tell Christian the hopeful that you must go through this or you cannot get to the gate, immediately what do? They begin to fear. They begin to ask, well, is there another way around this? There's no way I can get through this. How do I do this? Is it the same depth here as it is over there? Is it deeper over there? Can I find an easier way to get through this river? That's pretty reflective of how people regard death. Whenever you ask someone about death, a lot of times the conversation goes to, are you ready? Are you afraid? That's the kind of questions that people often have on people's deathbed, especially for people who do not have any hope, who are not believers. In fact, that's a very good way to tell someone about Jesus, is to talk to them about death. This week, our neighbor, we had a neighbor come in, Gary, he came and helped out,
with as I was trying to change a tire, and he knew that I was helping Jonathan's church plant. He knew that I was in ministry, and so he immediately just brought the conversation to that, and he gave me all the reasons why he's not afraid of dying. He's not afraid of death, and none of them really had, they all had to do with him and his own, I'm good, I'm doing this, I'm doing that, I believe this, and God is just a benevolent God. And, I mean, you have to fabricate stuff, but why are they fabricating things? And that's the question. Why are they fabricating things? Why are they trying to stretch their imagination in order to create this scenario where they don't need to be afraid of death? Why do they? Why is there almost this innate fear of death in the hearts of men? And the reason why is told to us in Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1, but I guess you could say the reason why a Christian, even a believer, kind of stumbled over some fear in this moment is because in the hearts of all men, whether you're a believer and you have fully believed and received the Bible and all its truth, or if you're not a believer, God has placed an awareness of his wrath upon mankind, upon all mankind. Van Til, Cornelius Van Til, a big OPC guy in our reform circles, he talks about this a lot, about how do we talk about what a person is and what, I mean, the human heart in its own natural state. And Romans 1 is the classic passage to go to this. The reality is, mankind has the existence of God written upon their hearts, and it's not that they're ignorant to it necessarily, it's that they suppress the truth and exchange it for a lie. You see, there's the difference there. It's not just I'm born without any awareness of who God is. No, this is telling me that biblical anthropology, a biblical understanding of the human person, of their soul, of their heart, of their mind, has an awareness of God, and not just God, but God's judgment over them for their sin. And what do you do? You put up a self-defense mechanism, and you suppress that truth, and yet there's still a seed of fear. Because why? Because they, I mean, when you suppress something, all you're doing is just pushing it away. And let's say you have a closet full of stuff that you've pushed into that closet. It's time to clean your room, Johnny. Okay, let's put all this stuff in my closet. Room is clean. See Mom and Dad? Don't open that door. Right? I've suppressed it. I've just moved it away so that I don't have to think about it. In Romans 1:32, kind of the one of the climactic points of this argument is just terrifying to me. Although they know God's righteousness, this is talking about just humankind. Although humankind knows God's righteousness, his righteous decree, although they know God's righteous decree that those who practice such things, evil things, deserve to die, they not only do them, but give approval to those who practice them. That's just twisted. Although they know that you deserve to die and that God's wrath is coming upon you, I'm not just doing these things, but I'm approving you. I'm encouraging you to do this too. That is a very grim reality, a fearful reality of the human condition without God's grace. And, of course, that means that we fear death without hope, without God's grace overshadowing our hearts. So how were Christian and hopeful supposed to overcome their fear of death? They were to overcome their fear of death. I guess you could say they were, how were they supposed to get through the water? Christian, for a while, as he was being despondent and fearful, he started to sink. And what you see there is a picture of Jesus helping Peter walk on water, right? As soon as Peter took his eyes off of Jesus and started to focus on worldly things, like you could say, he started to sink. And then as soon as he put his focus on Jesus, he began to float. I think that's kind of I'm not very big into allegorical interpretations very often here, but I think that's kind of what's getting at working here. He looked away from Jesus, began to fear, and he began to sink. Well, he lacked in faith. And then as soon as he looked in Jesus, his faith in Jesus and his power and love for Peter helped him out, and his faith was uplifted, and he started to. My mind just went through that imagery there. And of course, how do you overcome your fear of death? By flexing your faith and grabbing hold of Christ. What sorts of things aroused fear within Christian's heart as he was dying? What sorts of things aroused fear? So when Christian was started to sink, what was he thinking about? Let's just think about this process that goes through a lot of our minds often. Okay, so it's the fourth paragraph on the first page here. The last paragraph on the first page. So he began to sink, and Christian said, "Ah, my friend, the sorrows of death have surrounded me. I will not see the land that flows with milk and honey." Okay, so that's where it oftentimes begins, a statement. You get scared, and then you make a statement, and you start focusing on that statement, on that worldly false statement that you said out of your fear, not out of your faith. And so then what happens is you grab hold of that statement rather than on the promises of God, and you begin to sink and fluster and wallow even deeper and deeper and deeper. Some of you, I mean, we experience this all the time. Especially in a moment of being flustered, in a moment of anger, in a moment of, you make a statement, and all of a sudden for whatever reason, you just believe that statement that you just said out of your anger, or out of your frustration, or fear. Okay? So, he says this, and then Bunyan says, "And with that, a great darkness and horror fell upon Christian, so that he could not see in front of him." And then it begins to just go on, and, "I will not see the land that flows with milk and honey." Now, I've said that, I'm gonna believe that. Now I have to explain why that's true. So all of a sudden he starts being troubled by the sins he had committed, both before and after he became a Christian. And it was even observed that evil spirits were beginning to pester him at that moment. You see how this, I mean, just, it's just crazy how this happens to us all the time. A lot of times, if you think back to, how did I get into that down spiral? You can oftentimes just go back to, I made this statement and I just decided to claim that statement. Or someone made that statement about me and I decided to just claim that statement. So I had to give all these explanations and reasons. And then, of course, Christian says that the king, if, let's see here. So Christian answered, "It is you that they are waiting for." So Christian hopeful sees some people who are waiting for them on the other side. And Christian says, "It's you who they're waiting for. You have been faithful or hopeful ever since I met you." And then hopeful says, "And so have you." And then Christian needs to say, "No, that's not true." So he says, "Surely if I was right, the king would now arise to help me. But because of my sins, he has brought me into the snare and has left me." Now, what you see here is, the way you understand your sin at any given moment is going to affect the way you understand your circumstances, the way you understand your suffering. If you believe that your sin is completely forgiven and taken care of, washed away by the blood of Jesus, and that your Heavenly Father has thereby taken you into His number, into His family, your sins are dealt with. And that's going to change the way you view your suffering and your circumstances. You're not receiving suffering as wrath from God. You're receiving suffering as discipline from your Father. You see, there's a big difference there. And if you desire to lay hold of worldly false statements about you that totally change the way that you would have perceived your sin and everything, this is the situation that you find yourself in. So just helpful imagery here, allegorical imagery that I think we all go through this often, and Lord willing, we will not be going through this in our dying breath, that we will have our hearts focused and gazed upon Christ. And let's see here. Good. I'm going to skip question four. I was just going to make a statement there about, the contrast, I'll just say, the contrast between the two hills. So let's see here. Bunyan says, "Now you must note that the city, after they died, it says, the city stood upon a mighty hill, that the pilgrims went up the hill with ease." So if you remember, if there were any hills, in the past, there were often difficult hills to climb. There literally was a hill called Difficulty, and that was supposed to be an image of Mount Zion, of legalism, like trying to climb, ascend the ladder to the law, self-acquired righteousness. And here, on the other side of death, We are going up to the heavens, up to Zion, where God is, Jesus Christ is reigning. And that is going to be easy for us. Isn't that, I just hadn't put that together, that this imagery of the hill of difficulty versus the hill of salvation through faith in Jesus Christ. Jesus has already gone up the hill for us, and he has made the way available, and not only available, but easy for us as we receive receive entrance into the gates of Zion by faith. And that's a great imagery there. I really love that. And we could go into all kinds of explanations of why the hill of difficulty, the hill of the law is hard, the hill of salvation that Christ has purchased for us is easy. But I think you get the general principle there. And it's a helpful contrast that I've never thought about before. Okay, let's see here. Okay, so let's go to the passages where the part where Krishna hopefully received into the paradise of God. So, question 5. There are lots of descriptions of paradise, its glories, its gates, its city, etc. in this chapter. Perhaps some of it seemed a bit imaginative on Bunyan's part, or perhaps it seemed appropriately imaginative. So, I mean, here's the deal. Whenever you're thinking about Zion, you have to, you're given pictures in the Bible, but we as humans cannot help but imagine this, a picture of this. We just do. I've gone back and forth. I mean, some people will say, well, you shouldn't imagine a picture of God. And I think there's some truth there. There's the commandment there, do not make any graven images. And people will take that as, there should be a fear within your heart of erecting a false image in your mind with your imagination of what God looks like. What we know is what we have seen so far is that, first of all, he's Jesus Christ, which we can read about in the Bible. What he looks like is not, I mean, we know that he probably did not look, he was marred beyond human resemblance, so that's what he looked like on the cross. But that's beside the point, I think. And the images of God that he's given to us, pillar of fire. I mean, just things that are terrifying to behold, right? So, but when it comes to imagining the gates of Zion, I mean, we always are constantly imagining these things. And you're not imagining the face of God. So is it sinful? Not necessarily. Is it helpful? I personally think it can have some help. So one of my friends in 2015, wrote an article that was posted on Desiring God, a very popular blog resource website that's affiliated with John Piper. And I'm going to try and find that real quick here. If you just type in Imagine Your Way to Joy by Bryce Young, you'll find it. But he unpacks the fact that we as humans, God has given us an imagination. I can't think of any places in the Bible that give you a theology of the imagination. But it's there, isn't it? what do we do with it? Well, it's going to be working one way or the other, okay? We're either going to use our imagination to sin. So in this article, he talks about sin's imaginary world. That's how we sin oftentimes, isn't it? When you covet your neighbor's wife, a lot of times you're flexing your imagination in a way that it should not be flexed. When you are coveting your neighbor's house, you're imagining a world where you have what God has not given you, and you are using your imagination for sin. Our imaginations just kind of run and run and run. He quotes one guy here saying, let's see here, where was that quote? George MacDonald, who I don't know who that is, but George MacDonald said, the imagination will yet work, and if not for good, then for evil. If not for truth, then for falsehood. If not for life, then for death. The power that might have gone forth in conceiving the noblest forms of action, in realizing the lives of the true-hearted, the self-forgetting, will go forth in building airy castles of vain ambition, of boundless riches of unearned admiration. Which is basically what he's getting there is, imagination will work, and if it doesn't work for evil, it's going to work for good. So exercise self-control, fill your imagination with the images that God has given us in the Bible, I mean, Colossians, how do you, Colossians, I referenced this earlier, but Colossians 3, if you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds, maybe that's a reference to imagination, but you set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are earth. There's things in the Bible that you don't need to exercise your imagination. God says that you have been declared righteous. Done. That's a fact. Maybe there's some imagination. That's just a fact, okay? You are adopted. So that's some of those things that you can put your mind on. But then when you think about your heavenly inheritance, your justification, your adoption, your glorification, that's part of it. But when you turn to Revelation 21 and 22, where our heavenly inheritance is described, there is a place there, I think, where we have to flex our imagination and picture the things that are being presented to us. And what you have to do is you have to tether your imagination to the Bible and what it says with a holy ambition, holy aspiration for those things. I think pilgrims, I said in my introduction, what do pilgrims or sojourners do? They have a promised land that they're yearning for, and as they're yearning for it, they are typically flexing the imagination. I cannot wait till I get there. I'm going to have this. There's going to be this. There's going to be this. I get to be with God. Was Bunyan's description a little bit too imaginative? I think at parts, there were parts where I'm like, I'm not sure if I see. So this Christian and hopeful being escorted to glory with all these angelic beings, I'm not sure if I see that in the Bible. This great grand reception. I could be wrong. I would love it if one of you would email me and say, Peter, it's right here. You're going to be received by angelic hosts with this great reception that Bunyan talked about. I'm just missing it. So is it off and wrong? Yeah, it's possible, but I would rather flex my imagination on things that I know are true, that God has given me. So there, question five. What will we do in the holy place? So Christian the Hopeful asked, this is question six, Christian the Hopeful asked the Shining Ones, what will we do in the holy place? And this is a common question that we always ask. What are we going to do? Is it going to get boring? What are we actually going to do in heaven? Daddy? Mommy? What is it going to be like? And Bunyan's description there, I just found very, very, very helpful. You'll notice that there's language of passivity, meaning you're receiving things passively, for eternity, and there's things of activity, where you're actively engaging. And so the things of passivity, so Krishna Mahaprabhu asked, what will we do in the holy place? And the Ashrani one answered, you will receive, there's your passivity, you will receive comforts from all of your labor and have joy for all of your sorrow. You will reap what you have sown. You're receiving the things that you've sown, and even the fruit of all your prayers, tears, sufferings for the kings. In that place, you will wear crowns of gold and enjoy the perpetual sights and visions of the Holy One. For there you shall see him as he is. You're receiving that vision, and you are just enjoying it. How do you not use your imagination to enjoy this? Your imagination and your faith kind of go hand in hand here, I think. Especially as these things are an accurate description of what we have in the Bible. Activities of passivity. Now, things that we do that are more active, actively engaged. There also you will serve him. You're going to be serving the king. And how do you serve the king as you're receiving all these things? Well, you serve him continually with your praise, with shouting and thanksgiving, whom you desire to serve in the world, but did so with much difficulty because of your weakness and of your flesh. I love that. You're going to serve him in the way that you desire to serve him in this world, without the weaknesses of the flesh, without distractions of this world, just perfect praise of God for eternity. That's going to be glorious. And then it goes back into receiving, receptive language. There you will again enjoy your friends who have gone before you. There you will receive with joy everyone who will follow you into the holy place. You will also be clothed with glory and majesty and ride on a carriage with the King of Glory. That paragraph just generally, I found that to be helpful. And just it drew me to realize, what are we going to be doing Well, you're going to be receiving things and you're going to be giving things. It's going to be an eternal process of receiving and giving between you and the king. And it's going to be glorious. Okay. So some actual Bible. So where, let's see here. Randy Alcorn quotes J.C. Ryle. So Randy Alcorn wrote a big book called Heaven. You might recognize this. This is a small little condensed version. I recommend this to you. I found it to be quite helpful. He gets a little bit speculative at times, but you can generally see where he's being speculative. Yeah. He quotes a Bible verse and he says, now this implies that heaven will be like this. If you say implies, well, maybe that's getting a little bit speculative. But he gets to the heart of what heaven will be like and what we have to look forward to. What heaven is, I think this is pretty accurate. I enjoyed this little book. If any of you want to borrow this, I'd be happy to give this to you. I have not read the big one, so I cannot say that the big one is, I mean, it's big. I can't say anything about that other than the condensed version of it, very condensed, was helpful to me. But in that, Randy Alcorn quotes J.C. Ryle saying, I pity the man who never thinks about heaven. And Alcorn rightly responds, I pity the man who never accurately thinks about heaven. There's a lot of inaccurate thoughts about heaven, that we're just going to be some detached, immortal beings, just kind of impersonal, that it's going to be boring. I pity that man too. But even if he thinks about heaven a lot. And so what are some passages that you can go to? I'm just going to list some. Revelation 21 and 22, go there. Read it in one sitting. It's beautiful. It is the climax of the Bible. It's the last chapters in the Bible. And so read it, memorize it, think about it, and go to the passages that Revelation 21 and 22 are referring to. So in Revelation 21 and 22, you're going to see a lot of descriptions of that are referring back to Isaiah 65 and 66. There will be no more tears. There will be no more weeping. There will be no more pain and sorrow. There will be a new heavens and a new earth. So, meaning an actual earth. We're not just going to be, so chronologically, what's going to happen? We're going to go be with the Lord in immortal, our souls will go be with the Lord. And then when Jesus comes and returns and makes all things new, behold, I'm making all things new, he's going to establish a new heavens and new earth. And we will be given bodies, just like the resurrected Christ had a body. That's what it will be like. So Revelation 21 and 22 are describing that new heavens and new earth, according to Isaiah 65 and 66. The Gospels, Jesus' words often describe, I'm going to go prepare a place for you. So that means it's going to be a temporal place. We're not going to just be, yeah. His resurrected body, touch my hand. They're going to be physical. Romans 15, talks about, did I get that right? For whatever reason that just, I was wrong, I was right, that is wrong. 1 Corinthians 15, Romans 15 doesn't sound right. 1 Corinthians 15 talks about the fact that we will have bodies, and there's a lot of good descriptions of glory there. Romans chapter 8, creation groans for redemption as sons. There's some good descriptions of our hope there. Alcorn quoted Luke 19, 11-27, oftentimes there. He says there that in that parable you see that God has decided that we're actually going to help him run the universe. So that's a passage where you go to see there might be infrastructure where we're building and we're doing things that Adam and Eve are supposed to be doing before they screwed everything up. There's not going to be giving a marriage and reproducing, I don't think. I don't see any reference to that in the Bible, but, 1 Corinthians 6:2, this is one that I often think of. Paul says, do you not know that the saints will judge the world? We will sit at the right hand of Christ, and with Christ we will judge our enemies. Exactly what that looks like, I don't know, but that's going to come to pass. Hebrews chapter 4 talks about our heavenly rest. So we will be eternally resting. That's that reception language that we will be engaged with. And then 1 John 3:2, that passage just talks about how we will be glorified and see Him face to face as He is. And it's going to be glorious. So those are some passages that you can go to. Question 8, do you think we will ever get bored of praising God? So here Alcorn quotes Augustine. Really the only reason why I added this question in there, because I like this Augustine quote and I want to share it with you. So Alcorn quotes Augustine. Augustine said this, "We shall not be wearied by the praise of God, nor by His love. For if your love should fail, so should your praise. But if your love will be everlasting, because the beauty of God will be uncloying, inexhaustible, fear not that you will lack power ever to praise Him, whom you will have power ever to love. Fear not that you will ever lack power to praise, whom you will never lack power to love." Because you praise what you love. So long as you love the Lord and love what you see, you're going and rejoice in that, you will always be... So this idea that constant praising God is constant worship service, that would get boring if your love for God would die out. But God, the infinite eternal God, is going to give us infinite eternal reasons to love Him more and more. And I think there's reason to believe there that we are always going to be learning in heaven as God continually reveals Himself to us. It's going to take an eternity to exhaust the depths of an eternally glorious God. And so that's a wonderful thing. Edwards uses an asymptote, you math people out there, an asymptote, so you have the X and Y axis, the vertical axis going up and down forever on a graph, and then the asymptote goes up and up. And for eternity, it continues to get closer and closer and closer to that zero vertical line, but it never touches, but it continually goes up. And we're never going to be like God. We're never going to be God. We're never going to know everything about God. But for eternity, we're going to keep going up and up and up and up and up and up and up, and we will never, never exhausted, never become fully understanding, and we'll never become like become God, exactly. So that asymptote is another imagery of we're going to continually growing in our love and therefore be praising God, but we're never going to exhaust it. We're never going to hit zero, if you will. So, that's everything. As far as the question 9, what questions do you find yourself asking about eternity? Alcorn's book goes through a lot of those questions. Will there be time in heaven? Will there be X, Y, and Z in heaven? Yada, yada, yada. Again, some of those questions are a little bit speculative, but take it as you will, and never cease to put your faith in what's awaiting for you. So, and even flex the imagination in ways that are appropriate, ways that the Bible seems to incite you to flex your imagination as you yearn for your for that heavenly city, the celestial city. And so, there you go. A study on Pilgrim's Progress. I pray this has been helpful to you all, and I pray that God will continue to bless you all in your pilgrimage.